Hi, this is Steve, and welcome back to Illumini, where we hope to explore, inquire, listen, and learn. This episode, we're going back and speaking with Kelvin Duku, Program Manager at Gong Road Children's Foundation in Nairobi, Kenya. We spoke with him and had a conversation in February, and we just published that episode, episode 5. We went right back to him because of some of the rapid changes and that we're all kind of living with right now, the COVID-19 pandemic. How we're all going to experience it is going to be individual, but we also have a shared experience in that we're all experiencing it. So we're trying to get some understanding of how things are going on the ground in Nairobi, specifically in the slums, and more specifically among the students and the families that are served by Friends of Gong Road. And so I had a brief conversation with him and wanted to share that with you. I plan to go back and talk to more of the caseworkers in the coming weeks and get a sense of how the kids and their families are managing the situation. Could be quite a challenge. Schools are closed, there's curfews, and the means for any kind of income are severely limited. Friends of Gong Road initiated the Food from Friends program and getting some of the urgent needs addressed. Also launched the COVID updates page on its website to provide regular and current information about how the situation is being managed in Nairobi. So with that, here's my conversation with Kelvin. Okay, so I'm talking to Kelvin Duku and program manager at Gong Road Children's Foundation, and he's in Nairobi. He's in Nairobi, and there's things you might hear going on in the background, so please excuse that, because things are really busy over there, aren't they, Kelvin? Welcome.
Thank you very much, Steve. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great, and thanks for taking the time to kind of, I know you're really, I imagine you're really busy. Can you tell me kind of how your days are these days?
Well, my days are pretty busy with all the planning around managing the COVID-19 crisis, having scaled down our office operation to just a skeleton staff. So, but there's so much planning that has to go on in terms of our priorities. Right now, our priorities are food aid distribution and also trying to see how we can support our students to be able to study from home. So every day we have meetings with members of the staff, either mostly virtually, and we have documents to plan on the next day in terms of scheduling students for appointment, either to come and pick material from the library or come and access material from the internet. We have schedules for parents that we need to work on. So it's been pretty busy time for me trying to work around this crisis and also considering that there's a minimized movement and the whole issue about social distancing and safety measures given by the government. So yeah. A lot of our work been done, but mostly virtually.
So here's what I was wondering, what are the standards right now? What are the protocols that your government has instituted? Like, what kind of limitations are you operating under there?
Yeah, so there are a couple of limitations and directives given by the government of Kenya to ensure that people are keeping safe. And those include members are required to wear a face mask if they are in public. And people are required to actually to stay home and only travel when it's necessary. So government has insisted that people have to work from home. It even ordered employers to allow staff to work from home. And for those who are in the essential service businesses, they work up to around 3 o'clock. And government enforced a dusk to dawn curfew, which starts at 7. So even if you were to go to work, you have to be released by 3 to be able to get home in time before the curfew. And then, of course, ensuring social distancing. If, like, you're traveling using a matatu, currently the Matatus are only allowed to carry 50% of the passengers. So if it's a five-seater, even private vehicles are only allowed to carry 50% of the passengers to enable social distance. So if it's a five-seater car, it can only carry two people.
So that's pretty wild. So even the Matatus, so they're carrying probably what? And they're only carrying probably like 30 people in each one now,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right.
No, that's a joke. That's got to look different, though. I mean, does it? Can you noticeably change? Can you noticeably notice the difference in traffic and people walk? You know, is there less car traffic? Is there less or more pedestrian traffic? How does it even look?
It's very noticeable, actually, because knowing how Nairobi City is, with a very high population, a very high traffic. Right now, if you go to the streets of Nairobi, you'll be just surprised. There's barely nobody in the streets. There's no traffic at all. We only have traffic during the rush hours, like in the evening when people are trying to beat the curfew hours. But during the day, very few vehicles moving around and very few people in the city. Actually, you will not see people idling around. People are busy moving around and very few people. And it's a good thing because it shows that people are taking the measures serious and the directive serious, and people are staying at home and working from home.
So like
we've seen a big impact to that. I think the measures that have been put in place by the government, and I mean, people taking those measures seriously, has seen our curve of the COVID-19 cases change compared to what was projected. At least seems to be in control. So it's a good thing. At least people are observing those measures.
That's really amazing. So what's it even like in the slums? Because a lot of people in the slums don't have cars, and you know they walk a lot and they get around. Yeah. So what does that even look like? Are there people? Are they hunkering down there as well, or is it still pretty busy on the streets?
Well, for the slums, it's quite different because it's really hard to enforce some of these directives in the slum because these people, they don't have anything to eat. They don't have anything to do. I mean, they just can't. It's not even a good environment for them to lock themselves in the rooms. If they don't have food, then their rooms are pretty, you know, they don't even have good lighting. So you still find people in the slum walking around, people trying to see what they can do to get food. So in the slum, you can't really tell the difference. And even the mask, the face masks, people have not yet gotten used to the face mask in the slum because they are still waiting for the government to provide those. Right now, most people who have them are purchasing them. The government has not been able to distribute those to the people around. So in the slum, it's kind of almost life as usual as people try to find a way of surviving. And it's also very tough for them because most of them are no longer working because those casual jobs have kind of evaporated. They're not allowed to go to the suburbs to do the manual work. So it's just moving around and trying to see how they can find something to eat. But it's pretty tough for the slum life.
So what is the feeling going on? What are the emotions? I mean, I don't know if you've been able to go out or if any of the caseworkers have been out to visit any of the families. And of course, you know, there's a safety measures that really have to be a part of that as well. So I don't know to what extent are caseworkers able to go into the neighborhoods, into the slums and visit families. And then what is the feeling or the stories that they're coming back with if they are?
So basically, the staff are not, the caseworkers are not doing the home visits as they used to do. We have put those on hold because of the government directive. But we are contacting the families and students through phone calls. However, there are those staff who live within the community. So definitely they get to work in the neighborhoods and see how things are. And from the neighborhoods, people are really crying of the state in terms of food security. I mean, families not able to provide for their families, and also there's also a big challenge with paying rent. So just being able to take care of basic things like rent and food is the major concern for people in the community, especially in the slum area. And so that's what is really the biggest challenge for the community. That's all they're asking to, even from the government, is the government to support them with those basic amenities, like provide them with water, electricity, provide food, and also trying to seek government like support in terms of talking with the landlords to allow them to stay for this period during this crisis, because they're not working, they can't even afford to get the money for rent, and the landlords wants to kick them out of the houses. So trying to get the area chiefs and authorities to intervene and let the landlords allow them stay for this period. So it's really tough, but of course we have seen in some areas where some landlords have waived the rent charges for the month, a month or 2 months, because of the crisis. And people are just hopeful that other landlords and tenants will take the same move and allow them to stay for a couple of days without rent.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they're going to have somebody who has income to take the space. That's the part that's kind of crazy, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, so
at least for some are considerate to allow them to stay, because they understand even if they kick them out, where are they going to get somebody else who is able to pay?
Yeah. So, well, and I think that's going to be part of our process, to the extent that we can safely over time here, to be able to capture some of those stories about some of the families and what they're kind of experiencing over the next 2 or 3 weeks. We're looking at conducting interviews like this, or having conversations just like this with caseworkers from Gong Road. Yeah. And maybe get updates. And we're trying to make sure we're not getting in your way to let you do your job, but we're also trying to do our best to keep a sense of connection and support, and make sure that we're hearing things as firsthand as we can. So we really appreciate your giving us some of that information. Yeah. I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about how the Food from Friends program is going, because that was something that was, obviously a very deliberate shift in priorities because of the COVID-19 crisis and the diverting of resources to that, especially since the kids are not able to come to school or to the offices or things like that. And we put, some of that information on the website, and we're trying to kind of keep information updated on the social media and so forth. Well, so I'm just wondering if you can kind of give us kind of a summary of how things are going with that and how it's functioning and what your experience been with executing that program.
Yeah. So basically for food aid, what we've done is we've created some sort of a scheduling for parents to receive food aid. And we're targeting to at least reach all the families, because from an assessment that we did, we found out that 90% of the families didn't have any stable income, or most of them were no longer working. Only 10% were still working, and with time, we anticipate that they might end also up losing their jobs. So we are trying to work around issuing food to all the families. And currently we have around 300 families in the program. So what we've done is we've created a schedule where we issue food aid in 3 days in a week. That is Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. And how we do this is the caseworkers will book appointment with the parents, depending on the needs, and they look at our criteria, those who really need the food, who are in urgent need, and we slot them in a day. We can issue up to 50 families, and we have to observe certain guidelines. One of the guidelines is that we can only issue food to 10 families per hour. That will allow us to observe the social distances and all the other safety measures that were required by the government. So we schedule 10 families per hour, so we'll be able to do that within 5 hours to cover 50 families. Then the caseworker will call the families and let them know when they are scheduled, the day and the time, and the safety measures that they need to observe when they are coming to receive their food aid. So We have our food already packed into quantities. So we are issuing just basic food stuff that are in a common Kenyan or local person would consume in a week. Basically, it comprises of maize flour, beans, rice, some cooking fat, and some salt. And the food we issue can last a family of up to four members 1 week.
So I'm wondering, what I'm wondering is on the, that's kind of the distribution side, but even before that, how are you getting these kinds of supplies? How is that working out?
So what we're doing is we really appreciate the U.S. For the support and for the fundraising appeal they are running. We have had donors come through and really support the food aid appeal. We have had so much donations from our food from friends, and we're also trying to conduct our local donation appeals, which have also borne fruit. We've had been able to raise some substantial amount of money to purchase food aid. And what we do is we have a procurement committee that does procurement of food stuff because we buy this food in bulk. So we've identified a vendor who is able to supply us food at our cheapest cost. And so what we do is just place an order of a given amount of food, like 150 for 150 families. And then we make a payment and then we deliver to our office, and the food is already in smaller packages that are required to go to individual families. Then what we do is pack those foodstuff into smaller bags that we can issue to the families. And so when the families come to the office, we're able to give them a package comprising all the basic items that they require. So that's the process of procuring our food stuff.
Have you had any issues with any shortages on the supply side or delays or anything?
Yeah, we have had some delays with the vendors we are working with in terms of delivery. But eventually we've been able to sort out that so that at least we're placing our orders before the other bulk of our food item gets depleted. So we're maintaining a stock control so that when you're remaining with like 20 packages or 30 packages, we place another order so that we ensure that we don't run out of food supply. But the vendor we are working with is able to get food directly from the manufacturers. So it's not like a shortage in the food stuff, really. It's just a logistic issue.
So have you had to institute any special kind of security measures to, I mean, now you have inventory so much different than operating in office. I mean, what have you had any issues in terms of kind of needing to protect the supplies that you're getting in? I mean, is there any, or do you feel like your place, I mean, I know there's a guarded gate already, so I don't know, is that working, or do you have to do something else, or how do you even deal with kind of that part?
So we don't have a challenge with that because in the office we have a storage room. So when the items are brought to the office, and of course the vendor delivers the item at their own cost. So, and since our office is in a gated community in an estate, so it's a bit secure. We don't have a fear of maybe people breaking into the office to steal the food. So once the food is delivered, our accounts and procurement officer will just verify the quantities and that were requested. And then the food is stored in our store. And we only access the store when we're getting food to issue. So, and there's a control around the stock, the store inventory. So only the store and procurement accountant can access the store and issue food or get food from the store. So there's a good control of the food stuff to ensure that they are going to the right place and they are stored in the right way. And then when we're issuing the food to the families, we also have control around making sure that the family that has been appointed for food issuance is the one that is getting the food, not any random person. So we print out a list of the schedule, and the accountant has to check in as the families come in to verify that they are the family, and then they have to sign after receiving the food that they have received the food packet, so that we're able to know who has received the food and who has not yet received the food. And with that, we're able to keep track of how many have received, how many are remaining, and all that.
Wow. And I guess in some ways, it's just the fact that Gong Road has always operated basically as a one-on-one relationship kind of an organization. You probably know a lot of the people already that are coming in as family members because the caseworkers are familiar with them through their work. And it's not like, you know, that you have customers that are coming in that you don't know, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we actually work closely with the caseworkers because the caseworkers know all the families. So they're able to verify the family and it's quite easy. We don't have cases where maybe somebody shows up and we don't know who they are. We're able to tell which family member is and which child is represented in that family. So we're able to do that through the help of the caseworker.
So what has been the response from the families coming in when they receive this? I don't know if you have any particular stories or sentiment that people are expressing, but what's been their response to the provision of these foodstuffs?
The families are actually very appreciative of the support they've gotten from the organization. They didn't expect this. Of course, we know that our program's focus is education. And while we provide some food aid during the normal times, that food aid is actually limited to just a small number, the extremely needy who are maybe sick and they're not able to provide for the families. So most family members never expected that we'd be able to provide them food aid at such a crisis. And when we started, the families were so excited about it and they were so appreciative. And in fact, it was a bit tricky for us because we were given food on an appointment and they are used to, because we normally issue food during the holiday break, the December, the Christmas food packages. The families usually come, all of them together, to receive their food. But this time around, we are doing only on appointment. So it was kind of, they were not sure who is receiving this food. Is it going to go to everybody? Is it for specific people? So when we started the process, most families were very anxious about it and they were calling to inquire, hey, we have heard you're giving food. Are we going to benefit? So, and when we assured them, we have a process and eventually everybody will get a packet, they were so appreciative. I recall one case when we started issuing this food stuff, just the very first week of food issuance, families that came and there was a parent, a particular parent who was actually very sick and she was looking quite frail and weak. And so when she came to receive the food, she was almost crying, you know, just appreciating us for the kind gesture, because she told us her kids had spent 2 days without food because she was not able to work. She was very sick, actually. We could even tell from the look that she was quite weak. So we were curious to know what was happening. And so she shared that her children had not eaten for 2 days. Herself, she had not eaten. She was very sick. And, you know, she felt like this had just come at the right time. So such a situation is really what makes us, you know, keep going and really want to continue with this program and reach out to as many families as possible in our program. Because now we understand the kind of struggle they are going through. You know, having a sick parent, you're not able to provide for the children, and the children have come back home from school because the government ordered all the schools to be closed. So it's double trouble for the parents, you know, not being able to provide even for yourself, and now you have your kids with you at home and you're not able to provide. So this just came in handy for them and came at the right time, and parents are really appreciative of what the program is doing, and they feel so lucky to be part of this program.
That's really great to hear. Well, I want to value your time here, so let's kind of close this off and let you get back to your life and your work, and everything that you're doing really is appreciated. I know that everyone in the U.S. and, you know, around the globe, we're all really trying to make sure we're all going through this in our own way, isn't it? And we are all sharing this in some way, but we all have our own individual experiences. And I think the better that we can hear about each other's experiences and share those things. It's really helpful, I think, to get that. So thanks for your work. Take care, and we'll talk to you next time. So
thank you too. And I wish to send my regards to all the sponsors and donors and supporters of our program. We appreciate the good work they are doing. Thanks for reaching out for the food for friends appeal. This food is really going to have a great impact in the community that we support. And we really appreciate people out there going out of their way to just give towards this noble cause.
Thank you. I hope you appreciated that conversation with Kelvin. Get a sense of how things are being managed in Nairobi. I plan to go back and talk with caseworkers over the next couple, 3 weeks to see the impact the pandemic on the students, the children, their families, and the greater community. Please, you're always welcome to give feedback on how this reporting is going. If you like it and think it's worth sharing, please do on social media or tell your friends about it. In the meanwhile, I wish you well and see you next time.